continue in your service. Pray in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen. All right. So just to reset where we are, what has just happened? In chapter 12, what has just happened with Abram? Where is he? What's going on? There's a famine. He went down to Egypt. What else? Do you want to keep going or do you want me to have somebody else? Yeah, he was afraid that Pharaoh would take Sarah as a wife. So they agreed, say, hey, we'll just say you're my sister, right? So nothing bad would happen to him. How did that work out? Not well, right? Not well, especially for who?
Pharaoh,
right? So Pharaoh was and his house were struck with plagues. And so Pharaoh kindly tells Abram to get out and leave. And he didn't have a chance to make his way out. He was escorted out. So here, you get the boot. We'll see you later. Don't come back, right? So after getting escorted out of Egypt, now we're going to start in chapter 13. Where does Abram go? Back to? Back to Canaan? Yep. He goes back to Bethel. And Bethel, if you'll remember, is where he had been previously. He goes back to the altar he had built before, and he calls upon the Lord once he gets there. What do you think might be significant about him kind of going back to where he was and calling upon the Lord again? Yeah.
He took some things in his own hand. I know there's a famine, but I'm going to Egypt. I'm going to cook up this thing about Sarai and my wife. And God's like, no, you're going to go back to where I told you to be at.
Yeah. Yeah, and if you didn't hear JD, it was going back to kind of where he got started, right? He took some matters into his own hands, decided on some things that maybe were helpful getting out of the famine, but also not helpful in kind of deceiving Pharaoh. And the people there. And so I think this was an opportunity for him to potentially reground, recenter himself, back to where he had kind of first built an altar. Any other thoughts on that?
Probably praying about what's happening in verse 5 involving himself, the situation with his flocks and his herdmen and all of that.
Yep.
Was at hand, and he knew that. That's why he went to the Lord in prayer about that situation.
Yep. And we'll get to that here in just a second. So when he goes back, he's got his wife and all their possessions. The first part of the chapter here mentions that Abram was very rich in livestock and in other things. And he's also got Lot with him and all his possessions. So there's a problem that's coming up here that Gary alluded to. What is the problem that Abram has to deal with? There's not enough what? I'm sorry. Yeah, there's not enough land or there's not enough resources on the land for their herds, right, to compete. Lot was also wealthy, maybe not as wealthy as Abram was. It mentioned that Abram was very healthy, but certainly they had a lot there. And not only was there not enough, what else was going on? Yeah, there was strife between the herdsmen. So they were having clashes with the people that were tending their flock. And so this was kind of an emerging problem. We don't know if the famine that had mentioned was over. So again, it could have been kind of constrained resources as well that they were competing with. But it certainly could have exacerbated the problem with limited resources if it was still there. And it's interesting, right? So this is the land that God had promised. How does this land maybe look right now to Abram? Yeah, not very. I mean, this is the land that God has set aside for me, and here we are having these struggles. Had to leave it, come back, and now we're fighting amongst our peoples or amongst our tribe, right? So I'm not sure this promised land is really living up to maybe what Abram could have thought it was going to be. And the end of verse 7 has a sentence. Now the Canaanite and Perizzite were dwelling then in the land, and if you've read through this, it kind of just seems like a little bit of a, just kind of a weird comment. But why might you think that was there?
It is. It's an interesting place where that goes. But it's, what I think about when I see that is they had an enemy in the land, and yet they were quarreling amongst themselves. If they would have maybe put their petty jealousies aside and gotten together, and who knows all the variables that were involved in all that, but if they would have put their problems and thought about things together, they could have, you know, dealt with the enemy that was in their land.
Yep. Yep. Maria, go ahead. JD?
What she said,
yeah. Yeah, I think that also, I agree with both of the comments and your piggyback on one of the comments, or she got it first, I guess, not a piggyback, it's not fair to you. It's clear there were others trying to live off the same land, right? So there were other people there, which, again, makes this problem even more of a pressing issue. And then, if you think about it, if these two groups of herdsmen, Abram's and Lot's herdsmen, are fighting, that potentially doesn't reflect well on them, as kin, as family. And I also agree that, the leaving the record there and potentially non-friendly people to their cause, right? So that's the problem. And how does Abram solve this problem? Yeah, so Abraham says in verse 8 and 9, so Abram said to Lot, please let there be no strife between you and me, nor between my herdsmen and your herdsmen, for we are brothers. Is not the whole land before you? Please separate from me. If to the left, then I will go to the right. Or if to the right, then I will go to the left. What impresses you about this solution by Abram? Or what impressions does it leave on you?
Unselfish.
Very unselfish. Very unselfish. Right, absolutely. He really actually made Lot his equal in this, right? He said they're brethren. He said, we are brothers. Were they really brothers? Not by how we would kind of note the family tree. They were not brothers, but you can see where Abram kind of says, look, we're equal here. You're on my level, I'm on your level, we're the same. And Abram certainly, I think, also had the opportunity as his uncle, potentially who was older, higher up in the family, or older, or first in the family, maybe the one who was richer or more powerful, to have said, look, I'm going to dictate the solution here, but he does not, right? What else? Again, we said he gave Lot gave Lot the choice, gave deference to what Lot would choose. What else might impress you about this? Yep, sorry. He approaches this conversation, I think, very humbly. Right? You'll notice he says, please, twice. He didn't say, okay, here's your choice. Please, we are brothers. Let's not have this problem between. Please make a choice. Right? So I think he humbles himself here. Even his approach, I think, is enough to kind of to help diffuse the situation a little bit. Yeah, Kerry. Absolutely. Absolutely. Sorry, I was going to get to that in just a second, so you threw me off, but that's all good. One more thing I'll note about that is that he asks for Lot's help. Again, please help me. As he's giving credence to who Lot is and Lot's abilities as a person, as his kin, he's asking. So not only does he do it in a humble way, he asks for his help. And so why would Abram approach the situation this way? Yeah, I think his faith was showing here. Right? And so he knew that God would take care of him no matter what the choice or the situation might be. Why else would Abram approach a situation like this? Yep. Yeah, maybe he learned from Egypt that God would take care of the situation. And the way I wrote it down here is it gets him away from trying to solve or outsmart the problem himself. Right? I think so many times we can find ourselves trying to outsmart a problem. We can try to think of all the different ways to handle it, and sometimes we outsmart ourselves. And if we just trust in God and let him help us, that we might have been easier for us, right? One or two other things I had on my list. Anybody else? Why Abram would handle it this way? Well, I also noted that, you know, this obviously avoids conflict with Lot. And in doing so, letting Lot choose avoids either disappointment or resentment from Lot and Abram having chosen for him. So again, thinking about your choice, I'm not making it for you, whether you choose good or bad, you're not coming back to me. Sorry, you're not coming back to me on that, right? As Abram. And then I think this is continued trust in his promises to him. Not only trusting in God, but trusting in the promises that God would ultimately provide. So Lot has a choice. How did he choose? Yeah. Right. Yeah, he chose with his eyes. I mean, it says the first part of after Abram, and Lot lifted up his eyes. And when he lifted up his eyes, what did he see?
A lot of green.
A lot of green over by the Jordan. Well watered, I think it says in the verse. Very visually pleasing. Certainly had the resources that maybe that were lacking. Where they were, and he chose that land, that fertile land, for himself. So we know that Lot headed east to that land, and this choice had some consequences to it, right? And maybe not immediately, but here in the very near term, and then also in the long term, what were the consequences of that choice? Doesn't indicate that. Right. That's fair. Yep, Steve. Yeah. Yeah, his family does not go on a great trajectory. They go through lots of negative things, one of which we'll talk about, but you've hinted to the one in the next couple chapters. So yeah, and it foreshadows it in verse 12 and 13. Lot settled in the cities of the valley and moved his tents as far as Sodom. The men of Sodom were wicked exceedingly and sinners against the Lord. So, again, we'll follow Lot's story a little bit later and then in the next couple classes. But, Lot is pulled away by his eyes, right, and what he sees. Where else have we talked about our eyes leading us to making bad choices? Or not us per se, but in the Genesis story, people's eyes. What's that?
The garden.
The garden, for sure. This one sticks in my mind because I taught the class. So if that helps you as a clue, yes.
David?
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. Yep. Where else in Genesis? Think Noah. The whole problem of Noah's time was what? Everyone did what was right in their own eyes, and the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful, right? And started marrying among the daughters of men, right? And again, that's marrying not necessarily for spiritual reasons, but for physical attraction and whatnot. Corbin? Yeah, absolutely. So Lot goes east. And Abram settles in Canaan. Here's a map that shows where at least helps you visualize where they settled. This is actually the whole journey from Egypt back, but you can see, hopefully, if not, got a laser here. Oh well, it's over here, and you can see from Bethel, Lot goes east and then south to Sodom, and then Abram will eventually go south towards Hebron. And so what does God say to Abram after Lot departs? I Am I asking too many questions? Am I wearing you guys out with questions? Lift up your eyes and look, which is an interesting comparison to Lot. That's how Lot chose, right? So what do you infer by God telling Abram to lift up his eyes and look? Yep, all the land he would see would be part of the promise, right? But that Abram made his choice by faith and not by sight, right? That's, I think, a safe inference there, based on God telling him to lift up his eyes. And God says, look from the place you are, northward and southward and eastward and westward. For all the land which you see, I will give it to you and your descendants forever. Now, God had told him already in chapter 12 that he would receive this land. Why do you think he would reiterate it again here in chapter 13? He hadn't had an heir yet. Right, that's right. And I think it's very safe to maybe conclude that he might have seen Lot as his heir. And that maybe Lot would have been included in that promise. But now that they've separated, God says again, look, this will be to you and your descendants. Right? So Lot's out of the picture, you and your descendants. Remember, Sarai was barren. He had no children of his own. And God chooses this moment to confirm his promise to Abram. So Lot would have no part in it. Abram would again reinforce that he would have descendants and that they would be part of this as well. And so God tells Abram to walk about the land through its length and breadth, for I will give it to you. And he does so, and he moves his tent south to Hebron. And again, Abram builds an altar to the Lord. So, chapter 13. Any things I may have missed, or any other comments or questions? Yeah. Interesting. Good, great point. I hadn't thought about that. Anything else on chapter 13? Okay, we'll get into chapter 14. Chapter 14 starts out with a description of a political issue that really threatens kind of life and people in nearby lands, and will eventually threaten Lot here. And I decided to use a map here because this is one of the parts of the Bible, and maybe not just the Bible, but sometimes you'll read something and you're like, okay, I didn't really follow what's going on here, and I can read it again, and you almost have to map it out or chart it out to really understand what's going on. So this helps, and I'll try to summarize as best I can what's happening. And by the way, this is the first time, at least according to one of the commentators I read, that we see biblical events kind of coordinated with external history. Right, so I think we know that there's references to other things earlier in the text, but this is one that can kind of be traced back to the different tribes or the people. Maybe not every exact name has a trace back, but we can kind of see that the events that we know of in external history are now coordinated with the Bible account. So I thought that was interesting. So you have four kings, and I think we'll use the term king loosely. They were really kind of warlords or ruled kind of city-states, not necessarily big nations or countries that we might think about today from the eastern lands, and it's, I didn't practice these names, so we'll just go with it. Amraphel, who was from Shinar, Arioch from Elisar, Shurtalomer from Elam, and Tidal from Goim, and that's to the right. And these warlords and kings have been slowly moving westward and oppressing lands by force as they branch out from their region. And they had oppressed five kings near where Abram and Lot had, and of course this is where near Lot settled, for 12 years. So over a dozen years that the people there near where Lot were had been oppressed by these four kings or warlords from the east. And in the 13th year of this oppression, the five kings rebelled. against it. So they said, we've had enough. We're gonna push back. So in year 14 of this oppression, the kings from the east decided to respond with force. So this force is moving over towards the lands where Lot has settled. And we'll see he gets caught up in it soon. So these five kings who became allies to fight against the four are Bera from Sodom, Bersha from Gomorrah, Shinab from Adma, Shemember from Zeboim, and the king of Bela or Zora, who is not necessarily named. So by the way, this is interesting. The names of the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah, Bera and Bersha, are compounds of the word evil and wicked. So we continue reinforcing that. These were not good places. These are not necessarily good people. And interesting how those tie together here in Scripture. But these four invading kings end up taking Sodom and Gomorrah. The two kings of Sodom and Gomorrah, evil and wicked, I'll call them, fell into some tar pits nearby, and others escaped to the hills. And so the invading kings took all the goods from the cities, their food, and they left, also taking Lot and his possessions since he was living in Sodom. But in verse 13, we see that a fugitive kind of escapes from the hills and goes to tell Abram what happened. Does that account make sense? Took me a while to kind of figure it out. Hopefully I'm accurate, right? But also made it easier to understand. Does that make sense? Am I wrong somewhere? People who are smarter than me, which is a lot of you. Okay. So we just will zoom in a little closer. You can see the lands on the bottom here, which is where the cities were taken. And then you can also see Mamre, which is kind of where near Abram had settled, near Hebron. So what does Abram do? He goes after him, right. He takes trained men from his house, numbered 318. Again, we don't know how big the opposing force was, but certainly had to be sizable to take, I think, these cities. And took three others who he had aligned with. They were Aner, Esel, and Mamre. And they pursued these captors as far as Dan. And from the map and the scale here, that looks to be about 100 miles. So they pursued them 100 miles again. We have to think 100 miles is a long enough distance for us, right? But then these guys are on feet or riding animals or something. That's not a short distance. And when he gets close, he divides up his forces. He attacks them at night and defeats them, even going as far as Hobah, which looks to be another 40 miles further away. So drives them as they're trying to escape or get away another 40 miles in pursuit. And Abram and his men are victorious and brings back all the goods that were stolen, Lot, his possessions, women, and the people that were taken. So before we move on from this and look at kind of his reception when he comes back, what might you take from the story of Abram rescuing Lot? Sure. That Abraham was blessed and he had the resources to be able to do something like this. Yep. He was no pushover. That's great. Yeah. He's no pushover. How did he still feel about Lot? Yeah, he still cared for him. Still loved him. Right? Even though they weren't together, Lot has surrounded himself. Again, to Gary's point, whether they knew it was a bad city or not before they kind of moved in that direction. He went after him, even though he was in those bad circumstances. Okay. Yes, sir. Right. Yep. Yeah, it's a great principle, right, for how we help others in need today. Absolutely. Yeah, John.
And they have actually discovered up there the gate
Oh, wow. That's neat. That's very neat. Yeah, so things you don't necessarily see from a flat map with not a lot of different colors on it, right? The context of what, and then the ability to trace those things back to those times, right? And yeah, this was kind of the earliest part, I think, civilization that, at least in the reading that I did, that we were able to trace back and accurately connect. And so that's a really cool part of it, the gates of Dan that Abram may have gone through, for those of you who may not have heard. One other thing, what might you take, at least for me, what might you take from this story? In Sodom. He wasn't just in that direction, he was there, in Sodom, right? I think maybe this is what Maria might at least help bridge to, but what the people of Sodom and Gomorrah could not do, and all the cities before them, defend themselves against this force, Abram and his men were able to, right? So and I think we talked about this a couple weeks ago in terms of the ark and God shutting the door and whatnot. Again, we have a situation where these things can only happen because of God, not because of man. Right? I think this is another example that would potentially be seen of that. God here had a hand in helping Abram recover Lot. Anything else on this? Okay. We're getting into more fun stuff here, so this will be good. Upon his return, he's met in the valley by two kings, and I just wanted to compare the two kings and kind of the response and how Abram dealt with each of them. The first king was the kingdom of Salem. Salem, which would later be known as
Jerusalem,
was named Melchizedek. And Melchizedek, that was not the right one. Here we go. Melchizedek brings what to Abram? Bread and wine, and he offers him something else too. A blessing, right? So he brings out bread and wine, and blesses Abram. He's described as a priest of God. And in his blessing to Abram, he definitely blesses Abram, but he praises God significantly. And does he ask for something in return? No, thank you. I was about to say, this one was a 50-50 chance. No, he does not ask for anything in return. And how does Abram respond to this king and priest of God? Yeah, he gives him a tenth of all the spoils that were recovered, right? Which I think validates and shows his deference and his respect. He understood Melchizedek's place as a priest of God. The blessing certainly was oriented towards praising God, so he gives him a tenth of the spoils. Now we have the king of Sodom, who was unnamed. Remember, the prior king of Sodom, I think that was evil. He fell in the tar pits, right? So this was a new king. We don't have a name for this king. Offers Abram what? Offers him goods. Not only some, he offers him what? All of them. So all the spoils that were taken from the city, you can have. In exchange for what? The people. Right. So he says, look, you take all the spoils, you take all the goods, I'll take the people. And how does Abram respond to him? Yeah, he's pretty strong. He almost strongly rejects this one, right? And so just you summarized it well. I'll just read it anyways. I have sworn to the Lord God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, that I will not take a thread or a sandal thong or anything that is yours for fear that you would say, I have made Abram rich. I will take nothing except what the young men have eaten and the share of the men who went with me, Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre, let them take their share. So he says, look, I'm not doing anything. We ate food. That's what we'll claim. But anybody else who was with me, let them take their share, but I'm not going to have it because I don't want to associate really with you here. So what would you say about Abram here? What strikes you here about Abram? Yes, Steve? Yep. Yeah. We got a whole section on Melchizedek, so you're absolutely right. We'll get there in just a minute. I don't want to cut you off, but I know you'll have more to say. Yeah, sorry.
I find it interesting that he willingly gives up to Melchizedek, but gives everything up to the king of Salem, Sodom.
Right.
It's his. He earned it, but he doesn't.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, and the king of Salem had no claim, I think, to it. Right? But I think he recognized, Abram recognized who he was and was deferential and respectful towards him. I mean, yeah, Marie.
It's interesting that the story before this is like a physical representation of I will curse those who curse you. So like Abraham's family is taken into captivity, and Abraham comes after them, right? And destroys them. But here you've got the opposite. I will bless those who bless you. And you've got Melchizedek coming and offering, a blessing to Abraham. And you'll see that fully played out, like in Hebrews, like you said. But it's really interesting, those two contrasts of God showing spiritual blessing, that we can't even fully understand, but also the curse, in two stories back to back.
Yep. Yeah. Right. Yep. Yep. I mean, this really couldn't be any more of a comparison between good and evil, right? I mean, almost in the names and the cities, this is good versus evil, and Abram strongly rejected the one associated with evil. I think it shows a little bit of his contentment in what the Lord had provided and what would continue to provide for him. He was already rich. He didn't need more. Certainly wouldn't want more. Says he didn't want more. He aligns himself with the one who showed respect to and blessed God. And I think when we look at how he acted in chapter 12 with Pharaoh, this is a much different departure from how he interacted with Pharaoh, taking the gifts, on this deceit about Sarai. And I think it shows that Abram has grown in his faith. So we're running a little short on time, but this is a perfect transition. Steve started going here. I want to talk a little bit about Melchizedek. Really an interesting character. He's talked about more retrospectively than he is in the moment that we're talking about in Genesis. And I think that there's a lot that's really unanswered about Melchizedek in the Bible, which probably leads to a lot of different theories and a lot of speculation, but we'll of course try to stick with what Scripture tells us about Melchizedek. First, Melchizedek was the king of Salem, which Salem is translated to peace. So he's known as the king of, so he's the king of peace, as the king of Salem. The name of Melchizedek, that translates to king of righteousness. So, and we know that Melchizedek was not only a king, but also a priest of the God Most High. So, as Steve's alluded to, and maybe I should let Steve go for a few minutes on his knowledge of this, right, or what he thinks. He probably knows better than me. What is Melchizedek pointing us towards? Who is Melchizedek pointing us to? Jesus. That's exactly right. Yeah. No, you're good. Yeah.
Many think Job is a contemporary of Abram and Abraham. So God is having dealings with other people.
Right.
That is insignificant in the story of developing this scene.
Right. Yeah, I think sometimes we kind of forget about other people. And John, you and I were talking about this just yesterday. God had dealings with other people. And all those other people may not have been wholesale awful, wicked, right? They're just not central to this story. And so this Melchizedek character kind of suddenly appears and then through Genesis just kind of disappears, really only mentioned here in Genesis, but is mentioned in the prophecy of Psalms 110 that would be fulfilled in Jesus. Verse 4 of Psalms 110, "The Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek." And so, as Steve mentioned earlier, in Hebrews, we tend to learn a lot more about Melchizedek. So if you want to flip to Hebrews, chapter 7 is where we'll spend most of the time we have remaining. Hebrews 7, the writer of Hebrews goes into more detail about Melchizedek and his priesthood and the fulfillment of the Psalms prophecy in Jesus. What else do we learn about Melchizedek here and in the comparison to Jesus? What do we learn about Melchizedek from Hebrews 7? Yeah, I mean, Abram in the moment clearly recognized that by giving him a tenth or a tithe. And then blessings come from the greater to the lesser, right? So Melchizedek was clearly a higher figure than Abram, which I imagine to a lot of people was probably surprising, right? You think of the people at the time, right? Who's Abram, right? Abram is a significant figure, right? All the blessings come from Abraham, and here we have this character that's really at a higher place than Abram. So great point, yep. And not only did Abraham tithe, what does it also say in verse 8? Who else tithed? Figuratively, if not literally. And it says Levi tithed, right? Levi, who is a descendant, not immediate descendant of Abram, Levi also tithed. And so this Hebrews 7 is setting up that Christ's priesthood is better than the Levitical priesthood. And so when it says that even Levi, who was a descendant of Abram, through Abram tithed to Melchizedek, so the first priest, right, Melchizedek is higher than this priesthood, than the Levitical priesthood, as Christ would be.
Well, it goes against everything that the Jews that he's addressing would understand. Genealogy was everything. Genealogy,
yep,
was nothing to God who came to his son. He was like Melchizedek. He was without beginning and without end.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So we're talking about chapter 7, verse 3. Melchizedek had no genealogy. We do not know where he came from, who was his father, his grandfather, great-grandfather, nor who descended from him. And so why does that matter? Steve may have answered it. But why does that matter? It didn't matter, but it did matter when it came to the priesthood, the Levitical priesthood, right? It mattered everything there, but it matters nothing here, right? And so as we look to Jesus, was Jesus part of the tribe of Levi? What tribe? Judah, right? So again, make God appointed Melchizedek, God appointed Jesus, not based on who they were born to or their lineage or anything else. It was an appointment of God. So again, we're looking at Jesus as being different from the Levitical priesthood in Hebrews. Melchizedek was the same in that regard. He also held the title of king and priest, or most high priest, a priest of the most high God, like Jesus. These were the priests of Aaron's days did not hold the title, both titles. So again, you have a difference here. One of the things that I think is interesting and I think can get us hung up is Melchizedek, verse 3 says this, Melchizedek was made like Christ, not the other way around. I think because we see Melchizedek first in the Bible, it can probably lead to some confusion, or can hang us up as the phrase according to the order of, which really just means in the same manner, having similar conditions or properties. Melchizedek was fashioned after Christ, not Christ being fashioned after Melchizedek. I think it's an important point to note. One commentator said that the Hebrew writer says that Melchizedek is made like the Son of God, not that the Son of God is like Melchizedek. Thus, it is not that Melchizedek set the pattern and Jesus follows it. Rather, the record about Melchizedek is so arranged that it brings out certain truths that apply far more fully to Jesus than they do to Melchizedek. And I think we see, as we learn more about Melchizedek later on, in the Bible here in Hebrews, that Jesus was the one that set the pattern here, even though it says he was a priest according to the order of Melchizedek. What else do you gather from this? This is one of those, to me, this is one of those really interesting characters in the Bible. And of course, part of the point of our class is to point us forward, right? So this was really an amazing point forward. Very little mentioned when it happened live or in the narrative, but a ton of relevancy for us. Right? Right.
And that, you know, what Hebrews is all about is talking about Jesus is better than the law.
Right.
Which is another emphasis on the law didn't even exist then. You know, a priest of God is more than the Ten Commandments or, you know, the book of Leviticus. It is all about heart and service and, you know, who Christ has called us to be. And I think that's really concise in verse 11 through 17.
Yep. Yep, absolutely. Almost out of time. I forgot to hit fast forward or forward on those, but they're all the things that we've talked about, characteristics of Melchizedek. The other thing I'll mention before we wrap up, and I just found this interesting, and it's in the notes that Josh prepared as well. Melchizedek, again, not only giving a blessing, but what did Melchizedek give to Abram upon his return? Of bread and wine, right? So what else do we think about when we talk about bread and wine? Lord's Supper, yeah. I mean, so here we have this priest of the Most High God, also titled King, foreshadows us to Jesus. And the things that he offered to Abram were the same things that Jesus used to commemorate what he offers to us. And I think that's a really neat kind of tie together and full circle. So, other questions, comments? Was it not as interesting for you guys as it was for me? Yeah.
The one thing we didn't talk about was the fact that there was the prophecy also in Psalms 110 where David talks about Melchizedek in referring to Christ and the Christ to come.
Right.
He'll be a priest and king after the order of Melchizedek. It was all by design.
Absolutely. Yeah, David wrote that psalm, and it was the one I think I'll lay my enemies as a footstool to your feet is how it starts. And yeah, you'll be a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. That's quoted several times in Hebrews. That specific Psalms 110:4 is quoted back through the Hebrews letter. So. Anything else? Okay. Thanks, everybody, for your attention and your comments. Really appreciate it.